We as a nation in the United States like to pride ourselves on being a religious nation. Churches dot the landscape, you know, various pictures, whether the old Norman Rockwell type Americana pictures, the various churches dot the landscape. In fact, it's always been interesting to me, particularly in the areas of the South, most of the areas that I've been in, and out in visiting people in rural areas, when you go to give directions in a rural area, there is almost always one or two Baptist churches that, you know, kind of figure in the directions. I mean, you almost can't give directions in some of these rural areas without mentioning, you know, a church or two. Because, well, you go down that road and you come to that Baptist church on the corner over there, and that's where you turn. And that's probably the only landmark. And you go out through the woods, and you go out through some place, you go down through some road that you think nobody's ever been before, and you get down there, and there's a little church. And that's the landmark. And there's some little dirt road that goes out through the woods, and there's where you go down. And it's just, you know, it's a part of the landscape. Traditional pictures, and you've seen them, you know, of the little valley and the white clapboard church with a little steeple pointing up. And you know, what could be more religious? Now, in certain areas of the country, there are various types of religious artifacts and religious symbols and signs that you see up. It varies in different areas, you know, with the type of religion. Some religions go in quite a bit more. For that, I remember an area in Missouri. There were a lot of people in the area part of Missouri where we were, right, and of course over near the Mississippi River, there were a lot of German Catholics, a lot of German people, and they were basically Lutheran or Catholic, but there were a lot of German Catholics right in there on that stretch. In fact, there was an area on the highway between Cape Girardeau, Missouri, and St. Louis, Missouri, back before they got the interstate completed through there, that was a horrible road. It was a road that there were tremendous number of wrecks on because the road kept winding around. It was one of these little narrow two-lane roads and kept winding around and over a hill and around a curve. And there was a tremendous amount of traffic because this is the road that went between St. Louis and Memphis and coming on down south. And so all the big truck traffic and everything coming down, a tremendous amount of traffic going back and forth on this stretch. And with that type of road, of course, it's very difficult to pass. And yet traffic would get backed up and it would be going slow. And of course, you know how people are. They get frustrated and they're going to pass anyway, which meant, in many cases, passing on hills or curves, and the resultant fatality rate was very great. In fact, it was interesting. The only place I've ever been like that, but they actually had. You've seen these old Burma shave signs. You know, some of you remember back a few years back. I guess that's been, what, maybe 15, 20 years ago when those things really dotted the line of the landscape, these little things you go along and read. Well, they had some signs like that. They weren't up by Burma shave. The Catholic Church had actually put them up, and it was various prayers. Actually, what it amounted to was the last rites actually printed out on these little signs, and as you drive down the road, you'd read it off. You know, Hail Mary, Mother of God, and it'd just go right down the line on different signs. You know, you'd read off the whole thing, take about six signs. And so you could actually, get yourself prepared while you were going down car wreck alley there, because I guess they put that up, you know, figured that was I don't know how many people got in wrecks because they were reading the signs and not paying attention to the road. But anyway, you see those type of things. And of course, various areas, you have a lot of pictures, a lot of religious pictures, all types of little statuary and candles and incense. And in fact, when I was down in South Texas, somebody had improved on the market. They had put sacred incense in an aerosol spray can. And it was to be sprayed in a certain configuration. It was for sale down there. And it was I guess, the newest thing. Technology marches on. But one of the things, of course, people notice when they come in contact with God's church is the fact that we don't normally have a lot of the outward form and show of the things that people consider as religion. Now, of course, most of the places we meet are rented facilities, and so perhaps people don't expect to find steeples and funny shaped windows and various artifacts around. But if you were to go into an area, you know, when we built the auditorium, for instance, in Pasadena, or you were to go there on the big Sandy campus, various places where we have built, you don't find those things. You know, why is that? Is there really anything wrong with some of these symbols? You know, you find various little things that people wear. This has become various little trinkets to wear around, people wear around their neck. And you find everything from crosses to the signs of the zodiac to all types of things. And, you know, if you say something to someone about an item like that, their comment, of course, is, well, I don't worship that. You know, I know that that is not God. I don't worship that. If you were to ask someone who was, you know, had various of these artifacts maybe up in their home or wherever, they would tell you something similar to that. They don't claim that picture or that little piece of statuary is their God, literally. Is there anything wrong with it? Is it just a matter of your attitude? You know, well, I know that there's nothing. What about if you were shopping? Maybe you were visiting somewhere, and you saw some cute little trinkets. Maybe you were visiting in an Indian village, or maybe you transferred to maybe some foreign feast site. Maybe you were in Hawaii or some area like that. And you came up with some real cute little things. You know, they look cute. Maybe you were in an area and you see them around. Various little pieces of statuary that represent all types of, actually, pagan deities. You know, everything from totem poles to little miniature Buddhas to you name it. Is there really anything wrong with that? Is it just a matter? Well, you know, it's a matter of your attitude. You know, I know that's no God. I just thought it's kind of a cute little trinket. I like to sit it up here on my desk, or I like to sit it over here. Is that all right? Is there anything wrong with that? Well, I want us to understand some things today, and that I think can be helpful, and not just a matter of these things that are outward and that are obvious, some of the things that we might think of, but let's notice back in Exodus chapter 20. We read last week that God said that we are to have no other gods before Him. Now let's continue on to the second commandment in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 4. God said, "You shall not make unto you any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down yourself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Eternal, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto the thousands of them that love me, and keep my commandments." God says here, we are not to make any graven image of anything, any likeness of anything that's in heaven above, earth beneath, or the water below, that we should bow down and worship, that we should bow down to it or serve it. Now, what is God talking about here? We talk about idols and idolatry, and I think there are various ramifications of that certainly apply to us in our modern context that maybe we don't focus on as much. But I want us to focus on this commandment today and understand a little more clearly what God actually is telling us, what God requires of us, understanding that perhaps there are some areas that we haven't really thought about that we might be violating that commandment. God says that it is a very major issue to Him. Now, it's kind of interesting if you come from a Catholic or a Lutheran background, and I don't know, perhaps there are others as well, but I think it's primarily the Catholics and the Lutherans. If you learned the Ten Commandments, you know, as a child in the Catholic Church or the Lutheran Church, in the short form, you didn't learn about this particular commandment because in the way that it is numbered and the way that the commandments are memorized in the short form, this commandment is left out. You learn it, you shall not make any gods, have no other gods before me. you learn that the second commandment is don't take God's name in vain. The third commandment is remember the Sabbath day. The fourth commandment is honor your parents. Fifth commandment is don't kill. And then that the sixth commandment is don't commit adultery. Seventh commandment, don't steal. Eighth commandment, don't lie. And then when you get to the ninth commandment, you find that the ninth commandment, according to the Catholic and Lutheran rendering, is don't covet your neighbor's house. And the tenth commandment is don't covet your neighbor's wife. And so they come out with ten. Now, perhaps you didn't realize that, though I would say if any of you, those of you who have come from that type of a background, if you memorize those commandments as a child, that's the way you learn them. That's the way you'll see them printed out in their printed form when they go short form. And, of course, when you do that, there's one commandment that gets left out. It just kind of gets brushed over, and they say, well, we're not really leaving it out. That's just part of the first commandment. And, you know, we just say it in short form. We don't want to get bogged down with all this. But this is actually a part, as obviously when you go through here, this is obviously the way that it is, the way the Jews have always understood it, the way that they've always recognized it, and certainly a part of what God says. Don't make images that you are to bow down and worship. Now, what does that mean? Well, let's understand. Let's begin to go through some scriptures and understand how God actually amplifies this commandment and understand some of the ways that this commandment is violated. In Exodus chapter 20, verse 23, God says very plainly, "You shall not make with me gods of silver, neither shall you make unto you gods of gold." Now, what does he mean? You shall not make with me gods of silver. Let's turn on over to Ezekiel chapter 20, and let's notice another parallel. Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 39. "As for you, O house of Israel, thus says the Lord Eternal, go you, serve you every one his idols, and hereafter also, if you will not hearken unto me, but pollute you my holy name no more, with your gifts and with your idols." Now, how were they polluting God's holy name with their gifts and with their idols? You know, sometimes some people think of idolatry. If you were to set up an Indian totem pole and say, bow down and worship it, or you were to set up a golden Buddha and say, bow down and worship it, well, people would say, well, yeah, that's idolatry. But if you were to have a little piece of statuary that represented Mary, or that represented Christ, or that represented, you know, some saint or other, they would say, well, you know, that's not idolatry. That's not an idol. Why, we're worshiping, you know, we're worshiping God. This is just an aid in worshiping God. God said, you shall not make with me gods of silver. You don't make little artifacts of silver and call them by God's name. That's what he's saying here in Exodus 20, verse 23. Over in Ezekiel 20, 39, the one that we read, God said, look, if you want to serve idols, you serve idols, but don't pollute my name with your gifts and with your idols anymore. Now, how did they pollute God's name? Well, they took God's name and they said, we are serving God. And this little image over here reminds us of God. We're bringing this gift, which they then presented before this image, and they said, we're bringing this gift to God. God said they were polluting his name. God says that is not the way that he is to be worshipped. We don't make images to be called by God's name. Even, you know, you don't have to call it Buddha. You don't have to call it, whomever. Some of the name of some pagan deity, Baal or Moloch or Dagon or whatever. You don't have to call it by some pagan name in order for it to be an idol. God says, don't make something to call by my name, because you're polluting my name. You're polluting my name when you offer gifts in this fashion or when you worship in this fashion. Let's notice on over in the book of Leviticus. Chapter 19 and verse 4. God says here, "Turn you not unto idols, nor make to yourselves molten gods. I am the Eternal your God." Don't make little images. Don't make idols to, quote, remind you of God. That's not the way God is to be served. Now let's notice on over a little bit further in Leviticus chapter 26, verse 1. "You shall make no idols, nor graven image, neither rear you up a standing image, neither shall you set up any image of stone in your land to bow down unto it, for I am the Eternal your God." Now God is not just completely repeating himself here. There are several different things that are mentioned. You don't really get it from just reading the King James. It's not clear here. But the idols and the graven images were fairly similar. The idols had to mainly had to do with composition. But when it says, "Neither shall you rear up a standing image," this had to do with a particular type of upright obelisk. Is actually what it referred to. Kind of an upright. It was not a carved figure like a man or a cat or a dog or some animal or something. It was basically just an upright, image, an upright pole, normally made from stone. That had to do with. Now, what about that? Well, we're going to see about that in just a minute. Or any image of stone, and this had to do more with the like an icon. This was a particular type of artwork. God specified several types of artwork. Not the artwork was prohibited, but making something of a religious nature that you would bow down unto it. All right? So we see that we were forbidden here to make things that we're to bow down to, that we use as an aid or an instrument of worship. People say, well, you know, we're not worshiping that image. We're not worshiping that picture. We're not worshiping that statue. We're trying to worship God. We just need something to help remind us of God. Notice what Jesus Christ said back in John chapter 4. John chapter 4, verse 23. Jesus said, "The hour comes, and now is, when the true worshiper..." Now, you want to be a true worshiper of God? "The hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshiper shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeks such to worship Him. God is a spirit, and they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth." God says that we are to worship Him in spirit and in truth. God is a spirit. We're to worship God in spirit and in truth. We're not to worship God using various physical artifacts, various physical images. We're to worship God in spirit. Now, we're going to come back and we're going to tie in some of these things a little later, but we notice this particular reference in Leviticus 26, verse 1, where it talked about the upright images, or the upright stone, the obelisks, actually is what it refers to. Notice back in Jeremiah 43. Jeremiah 43, verse 13. God talks about here how He's going to smite the land of Egypt. In verse 12, "I'll kindle a fire, and the houses of the gods of Egypt shall burn them." Verse 13, "He shall break also the images of Beth Shemesh that is in the land of Egypt, and the houses of the gods of the Egyptians will he burn with fire." He shall break also the images of Beth Shemesh. Now, what is that? Well, Beth Shemesh means in Hebrew the house of the sun. So this was, Beth Shemesh was a city in Egypt. And the name meant the house of the sun. This is the Hebrew form of the name. It is known today, the more common name that it is known by is the Greek name, Heliopolis, which again means the city of the sun, the city of the sun god, Heliopolis. Now there was this term, the images, verse 13, is a particular word in the Hebrew. It is the same word that was used back in Leviticus 26:1 that means an upright obelisk. An upright obelisk. And it basically was the symbolism. It was a fertility symbol. It was a phallic symbol. That's what it was designed for. That's what it represented. And that was the symbol of the sun god, the life giver. You see, that was why they used the sun. That was why they used the symbolism. I don't think I have to be much more explicit than that. And this was an image that was set up there in this Egyptian city of Heliopolis or Beth Shemesh. Now, it's an interesting story what's happened to that particular obelisk. Did you realize that obelisk is an image of great religious significance in the world today? This image, this particular obelisk, is still around. Now, it's not in Egypt anymore. No, it left Egypt. It left Egypt over 1900 years ago. There was a Roman emperor, a man by the name of Caligula, that decided that, this image, this particular obelisk, this center of sun worship there in Egypt, in Heliopolis, or Beth Shemesh, was too good to leave in Egypt. It was such a tremendous symbol that we needed to move it. So it was a tremendous feat. But the Emperor Caligula removed this particular obelisk from Heliopolis in about 40 A.D., and he carried it to Rome, logical place, and he erected it in his circus on Vatican Hill. Now, of course, a little bit later, the show changed, and it wasn't Caligula's circus on Vatican Hill anymore. There was something else that was going on. This became a great religious headquarters. And the building known as St. Peter's Basilica, was built there. And this great obelisk was remaining right there, pretty much in the center. But when they built St. Peter's, the obelisk was off-center. And so in 1586, Pope Sixtus V actually had the obelisk that Caligula had brought from Heliopolis, had the thing moved over a few feet so that it would be exactly centered before the entrance into St. Peter's. And in fact, it's interesting when you read the story and the number of teams and everything. There was a death sentence on anybody. He pronounced a capital sentence on the workman if anything happened to the obelisk. Woe be, if you break the thing when you move it. And they didn't break it, and so they got special blessing. It's an interesting story when you want to read it, but it was actually moved to its present location in 1586 by Pope Sixtus V. And it only amounted to a very short distance. It was there on the same general location, but it was moved over to be exactly centered. Now, it is quite an obelisk. There were two other obelisks that were brought from Egypt. Ironically enough, one was set up in London, and one was set up in Central Park in New York. And so our people, Israel, have managed to import obelisks from Egypt that were moved at a later date and brought over here. And so we've got one, too. We can really be proud of that. One of the standing images, the obelisks, the symbols of the sun god, the fertility symbol. Now, it didn't stop with that because, you see, everybody can't afford the real thing. Everybody can't go to Heliopolis and move one over. There weren't that many. So, of course, replicas abound. And that is why the obelisk in the form of a steeple, and a steeple is just a modified obelisk. That's where it comes from. It's interesting. Just read it in any encyclopedia on religious history, that it is simply a carry down of the obelisk, of the religious symbolism of an obelisk. And God refers to it back in the book of Ezekiel to the type of things that the Israelites were doing that of erecting these various obelisks and all the things that went with it. Yeah, Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 17. Then he said unto me, Have you seen this, O son of man? Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence and have returned to provoke me to anger, for they have put the branch to their nose. Now that's the way it reads in the King James, but this term is actually in the original it reads, they have put the branch or the Asherah to my nose. Now, there are what are known in the Old Testament as the 18 emendations of the Sopharim. Now, the Sopharim were the scribes that copied out the Old Testament. They made 18 changes, and they actually kept record of the places where they changed. And these changes basically had to do with something that they felt kind of cast a bad reflection on God, or were disrespectful toward God, and so they changed the word and made a notation in the margin of what the original was. They changed it as to the way it was read in the synagogue, and yet they made a notation because they were bound, you know, as God explains in Romans 3, they were bound by God's faithfulness to preserve every letter. And so they did, even the changes they made, there's actually a list that they made 18 changes. They changed 18 different words, and this is, you can check it up, the Companion Bible, Bullinger's Companion Bible brings it out, in fact lists all 18 of them, if you want to go back and check it out. But actually it reads, they put the Asherah to my nose. And when you go through and you check it out, actually what it is referring to is here, you know, this obelisk, this steeple, this is what they were actually putting up, pointing up toward God. God said, you know, they're taking that filthy thing and they're sticking it in my face. They're pointing it up toward me. That's actually what he refers to, and refers to it as one of the abominations of Israel. Now, you know, God evidently isn't too pleased with the landscape that dots our land. God is not impressed by what great religious people we are. Let's notice a little more information that God brings out in this regard. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 15. Take you therefore good heed to yourselves, for you saw no manner of similitude on the day that the Eternal spoke unto you in Horeb out of the midst of the fire. Now here's Moses' parting words to the Israelites, and he says, look, now I want you to remember something. When God spoke to you and gave you the Ten Commandments, you did not see anything, did you? No, we didn't. You know, you didn't see an image. And he says, I want you to remember that, lest you corrupt yourself and make you a graven image, the similitude of any figure, likeness of male or female, likeness of any beast that is on earth, likeness of any winged fowl that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, the likeness of any fish that is in the waters beneath the earth, and lest you lift up your eyes unto heaven, and when you see the sun and the moon and the stars, even all the hosts of heaven, should be driven to worship them and serve them, which the Eternal your God has divided unto all the nations under the whole heaven. But God has brought you out, and you're here, you're to be unto Him an inheritance. Well, he says, now look, you know, you don't go out and make some type of an image to worship. That's not the way that God is. Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 21. Now, here it brings out, you shall not plant you a grove of any trees near unto the altar of the Eternal your God, which you shall make you, neither shall you set you up any image which the Eternal your God hates. Now, this particular grove was an Asherah. It was a grove that was used for idolatrous purposes. Normally, pagan churches were set, pagan places of worship were always set on a hill in a grove of trees, surrounded by a grove of trees. That's kind of interesting, you know, because that is the standard way that we have these little, rural churches all over the country. They're always on a hill in a grove of trees. like they went back and they read in Deuteronomy 16:21 and said, well, now it says, don't here plant any grove of trees near to the altar. Well, here, let's build us one, just like God said not to do. Neither shall you set up any image which the Eternal your God hates. Not to set up any statue, any upright obelisk, any steeple, anything like that, which God hates. See, it's a pagan symbol. Symbol of the fertility rites, the sex worship. And this, of course, is what usually went on in the groves. The type of symbolism that was connoted. Notice on over in Micah. Micah chapter 5. Pick it up in verse 10. It shall come to pass in that day, says the Eternal, that I will cut off your horses out of the midst of you and will destroy your chariots, our armaments in which we trust. And I will cut off the cities of your land and throw down all your strongholds. And I will cut off witchcrafts out of your land. There shall be no more soothsayers. God says He's going to get rid of astrology and He's going to get rid of fortune tellers. You know, those things are an abomination in God's sight. Your graven images also will I cut off, and your standing images, your obelisks, your steeples, will I cut off out of the midst of you, and you shall no more worship the work of your hands. I will pluck up your groves out of the midst of you, so will I destroy your city. And I will execute vengeance and anger and fury upon the heathen, such as they have not heard. So God is not pleased with the religion that this nation likes to pride itself on. Notice back in 1 Kings chapter 14, a couple of examples back here of how far the Israelites got off. A couple of examples here, 1 Kings 14, verse 15. Pick it up in verse 14. Moreover, the Eternal shall raise him up a king over Israel, who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam that day. But what? Even then. For the Eternal shall smite Israel as a reed is shaken in the water, and he shall root up Israel out of this good land which he gave to their fathers, and shall scatter them beyond the river, beyond the Euphrates, because they have made their groves, provoking the Eternal to anger. He shall give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam, who did sin, who made Israel to sin. Now, coming on down a little bit further, verse 23, for they also built them high places, and images in groves on every high hill and under every green tree. There were also sodomites in the land. So God links idolatry and all of the the homosexuality. You know, and God says He's going to root up Israel. And He rooted up Israel out of the land of old because of the type of things that they had. They built them high places. They had all their little places of idolatrous worship. And they had their images, their obelisks, their groves on every high hill, under every green tree. You know, that's where they went and planted. And they had these places of idolatrous worship. God is not pleased with that. God does not say that we are to devise in our own minds the way that we would like to worship Him and then go do it, and He'll be satisfied. You know, God doesn't say you can do anything you want to as long as, you know, basically you've got a good attitude about it, and your attitude's right, and you're just trying to serve God. God doesn't care what you do. Oh, yes, God does care what you do. Well, sure, attitude's important, that's right. God says we're to worship Him in sincerity and truth. You know, there are a lot of people that have a good attitude. They're sincere. You know, if you're sincere, you basically have a good attitude, right? But God says that just worshiping Him in sincerity is not enough. You have to worship Him, we're told, in sincerity and truth. That's what we're told back in 1 Corinthians. Christ states it in 1 John, or not in 1 John, but in John chapter 4, in spirit and in truth. And that would correspond, you know, with your heart. But truth, we also must worship God in truth. It's not enough to just worship God the way that you think ought to be okay. You have to worship God the way God says is okay. God is not pleased, God is not satisfied with our using our own imagination and our own way to concoct our own invention in terms of religion. Now, what about pictures of Christ? You know, we see here not to make any images of God. What about pictures of Christ? Surely, you know, is there anything wrong with that? Notice, to begin with, let's notice a couple of things. God emphasized that we were not to make any images of God. We were not to, to make an image of God. Well, what about Christ? Well, notice John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, of course, the Word is Jesus Christ. Here we're told that the Word, Jesus Christ, was God. Notice back in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 8. But unto the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. And a scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. Unto the Son, he says, your throne, O God, Jesus Christ, is God. So any commandment or any prohibition that attaches to God also applies to Jesus Christ. Now the images, the various pictures, the various statuary, the various paintings that purport to represent Jesus Christ give a completely wrong, distorted picture. They don't even look at all like Christ looked. In fact, they look the very opposite. We're told, for instance, in Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 14, for it is evident that our Lord sprang out of Judah. Very plainly, Jesus Christ was a Jew. Now the pictures, the various little pictures and statuary and things like that, the features are anything but Jewish. They certainly don't look Jewish. The coloring is not, the features are not usually very kind of thin and soft and aquiline features looking with a feminine type of a softness. Not at all like Jesus Christ looked, and we're going to prove that in just a couple of minutes. Number one, Christ was a Jew. This is very plain. Notice on over in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 14. Does not even nature itself teach you, if a man have long hair, it's a shame unto him? Now it makes the point on up here in verse 4 that any man who has long hair actually dishonors Jesus Christ. What it says in 1 Corinthians 11, 4, I'm just paraphrasing. Now, Jesus Christ, very obviously, did not have long hair. And yet, all these pictures always picture him as having long, flowing locks. Well, he says any man that wears long hair is actually directly dishonoring Christ, and that it is a shame, even just from a natural standpoint, even leaving God out of the picture. It's a shameful thing. So, obviously, Jesus Christ did not wear long hair. And yet, all these pictures always picture, long, flowing locks. All right? Let's notice back in Isaiah 53. Jesus Christ is generally pictured painted in a way as to look very soft and feminine and with an outward beauty almost. In fact, there's usually kind of a halo and painting around there and this kind of sticky, sweet smile on his face. We're told here in Isaiah 53:2, for he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, as a root out of a dry ground. He has no form or comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. Jesus Christ did not outwardly appear as a very attractive individual. Says he has no form or comeliness. No beauty that when you see him, you should desire him. In other words, he didn't appear, with some soft, feminine, beautiful type of appearance, that he was not, what you'd call even exceedingly handsome. There was no particular physical characteristic, nothing about his face that made him seem so desirable. All these pictures give a completely wrong, distorted view. When you see the ones of the crucifixion, they usually show like a little drop, maybe a little drop of blood here or there. Well, it goes on. and talks about the way that Christ looked when he was crucified in Isaiah 52:14. As many were astonished at you, his visage was so marred more than any man, his form more than the sons of men. In other words, he was unrecognizable. He had been beaten to a bloody pulp. As that Roman cat of nine tails had ripped his flesh, he was literally unrecognizable. If you've ever seen someone that perhaps has been involved in maybe a serious automobile accident or something, and her face is all puffy and swollen and bloody, and you look at them, even someone that you've known real well for a long time, and you just almost can't recognize them. It's hard to actually recognize them. So what do these pictures do? Well, they completely distort and pervert what Jesus Christ is like, completely distort what his sacrifice is all about. They don't convey any of this. Jesus Christ is generally pictured in these pictures as he's pictured either as a helpless little baby in his mother's arms or a dead man hanging on a cross. Now, what is Jesus Christ like? How does Jesus Christ appear? Well, the only picture that we're given, the only description in the Bible that you're really given of the way Jesus Christ looks right now is given back in Revelation chapter 1. Verse 13, in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the floor, or down to the foot, girt about the paps with a golden girdle. His head and his hairs were white like wool, as white as snow. His eyes were as a flame of fire. His feet were like unto fine brass as they burned in the furnace. His voice is the sound of many waters. He had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was as the sun shines in his strength. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead. Literally collapsed. Fainted. Certainly nothing like the pictures that are painted that simply serve to obscure the truth. And that's why God hates this type of thing. Because it gets people's mind off of the truth. It completely fills their mind with all types of wrong concepts. Now, how do you treat? What do you do with things like this? You know, and sometimes people have little artifacts. Maybe, like I say, maybe a little Buddha they picked up, or a little Indian totem pole, or this or that, various things of pagan significance. What should you do with that? You know, maybe put it up on your mantle and look at it. Oh, I don't worship it. You know, I just think it's cute. Well, does God think it's cute? Let's notice back in Exodus chapter 23. What did God instruct the Israelites to do? Exodus 23:24. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do after their work, but you shall utterly destroy them and quite break down their images. Now God said, when you come into the land, you don't take the little images that the pagans had and kind of sprinkle something on them and say, we're going to call this by God's name now. We won't call this Molech or Dagon or whoever. We're going to call this by God's name. Isn't this cute? You know, like the statue of Jupiter Olympus, which was renamed St. Peter and was set up there in the Vatican. And that's literally true. The scepter was actually cut out of his hand, replaced by keys. That was the only change made. And in fact, it's a matter of historical record that it was the ancient Roman statue of Jupiter Olympus. It was originally made to represent Nimrod. That's why the whole statue is black. Peter was not a black man. He was a Jew. Others there are many in the church and certainly, people of all various races and things that were in the church. That was who the statue was originally made to represent. Jupiter Olympus, made to represent Nimrod. That's why it looks like it does. If you've ever seen a picture of it, it certainly doesn't resemble St. Peter. The terminology saint. People don't understand what that is. Well, if you have God's Spirit, you're set apart, you are sanctified. That is what makes, if you're one of God's people, you are a saint. Paul wrote to the church, he wrote to the saints that were in Colossae or the saints that were in Ephesus. It's not a title to be attached to, you know, certain just certain individuals. Okay, let's notice on over in Exodus 34:13. You shall destroy their altars, break their images, and cut down their groves. That's what God said we were to do. You were to destroy their altars, break their images, cut down their groves. Numbers 33. Numbers 33:52. Then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their pictures and destroy all their molten images and quite pluck down all their high places. God says we're supposed to get rid of it. Notice on over in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 5. Thus shall you deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their images, cut down their groves, and burn their graven images with fire. Now God's going to upset a few people when Christ comes back, establishes the millennium. A lot of what people think are great artworks, great works of art, God's going to destroy. God's going to burn it up. Some people are probably going to be a little bit horrified. They're going to think, oh, that's terrible. You know, that's a great work of art. Well, God says it's an abomination to Him. Well, God's not impressed by some of these big, fat, leering Buddhas. God's not impressed by all various amulets, various symbols of astrology and things like that. You know, it's a bunch of demonism and witchcraft. And God hates that kind of thing. And He says it's to be destroyed, it's to be burned, it's to be absolutely broken up. You're not even to take it out and give it to your neighbor. It was to be destroyed, absolutely obliterated. God hates that kind of thing. You know, it's a matter that God's very plain on it. It's what Israel was to do. Of course, Israel hasn't done that. People think, oh, that's nice, you know, sell it for tourist trinkets. There are various things you can go through. It's very obvious the kind of thing the Apostle Paul taught on the subject. Because, when you read the story back in Acts chapter 19, pick up the story back here. Acts chapter 19, verse 23, in the same time there arose no small stir about that way. What Paul taught was not a one-day-a-week religion, it was a way of life. And there arose no small stir about that way. For a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, which made silver shrines for Diana, brought no small gain unto the craftsmen. Now here was a great, you know, here was a real economic boon. Here was something really going on here. And here was a man that was a silversmith. And they made little idols. They made little trinkets, various little artwork, pieces of artwork out of silver. And they got rich off of it. Whom he called together with the workmen of like occupation and said, sirs, we know that by this craft we have our wealth. Look, you know, we got a good deal going. We're getting rich off this. We've made a lot of money. Moreover, you see and hear that not alone at Ephesus, but almost throughout all Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away much people, saying that they be no gods, which are made with hands, so that not only this our craft is in danger to be set at naught, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised, her magnificence should be destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worships. Now Paul was about to put these guys out of business. Paul went around preaching the way a lot of people preach today. He would have said, well, look, now, you people shouldn't call this, you know, you shouldn't set this thing up and say you're worshiping Diana anymore. Why don't we call it a statue to the Virgin Mary? Why, he'd have cranked up these guys, he'd have got these guys some more business. He'd have drummed up a little extra business for them. They'd have been glad to see Paul come to town. He taught the way a lot of people may. He said, well, look, you know, you can manufacture silver crosses, and you can, make various little artifacts, various little religious symbols. All taught what a lot of people teach today. These silver merchants, these silversmiths in Ephesus wouldn't have been so upset at it. They actually got a riot started because Paul was about to put them out of business by what he taught. Now, these things, you know, even the very symbol of the cross itself. You know, it's interesting. You can look, if you get some books on, for instance, the early history of America, you know, it's just a matter of historical record. There are the symbol of the cross was very widely used in religious symbolism in pre-Columbian America. It figured in the religious usage of the Indians, certainly the Mexican Indians. It figured in religious usage down in Africa. It figured there are iron crosses, there are metal crosses, stone crosses used that were discovered by archaeologists down in Central Africa. There are tombs in Egypt where the cross is engraved in there, various types of crosses. Because, you know, there are various types of crosses. There's the Latin cross and the Greek cross, the Maltese cross, St. Andrew's cross, the various types of crosses. Well, they all look a little different. They can't all be what Christ was crucified on. In fact, very likely none of them are what Christ was crucified on. Because the Greek word that's used, the translated cross in our English Bibles, with the exception of one place, it's translated tree back in Peter, in one place, but it's the Greek word staros, means an upright pole or stake or tree trunk. And it doesn't necessarily carry the connotation at all of what kind of cross piece that it had on there. Well, that's merely a matter of conjecture. But, you know, the idea of kind of wearing something or viewing something as a good luck charm, it's interesting. You know, I'm not going to go back, but if you go back to Genesis chapter 4, in Genesis chapter 4, where Cain killed Abel, and God exiled Cain into the land of Nod, he set up a mark for Cain, a mark or a sign. The Hebrew word translated mark is the Hebrew word O-W-T-H. It is a mark, a sign, a beacon, a flag, some type of symbol that he set up. It was actually a boundary mark to differentiate between the land of Eden and the land of Nod. That was set up to actually kind of make the demarcation there as to the land where Cain was and beyond which no one else, the rest of the human race, was not to go. It was a marker, a beacon that was set up for Cain. And when you study into it from a historical standpoint, you get an idea as to, you know, a very logical way you want to call people's attention to something. You take, you know, make up some type of, you know, some type of a cross piece, take a couple of logs or something, lash them together and put them up as like a sign to catch people's attention. And it actually came to be viewed by the descendants of Cain as a good luck charm because that was, you know, what protected Cain's life. Probably Cain himself, certainly his descendants, came to actually wear a small miniature version of this around their neck is like an amulet, something to protect them as a good luck charm. And that was actually the symbol of the cross, the shape there. It gave its where the letter T comes from, as a matter of fact. It became the symbol of Tammuz in the post-flood world. And it was the symbol that stood for him was the letter Tau, the first letter of his name, which was made in the shape of this good luck charm that stood for Tammuz. Kind of an interesting story. You can go through, trace it through, and the way that it actually came in was not even attached at all to Christian worship until over, so-called Christian worship, until over 300 years after the time of Christ. But, you know, there are many things that come in. And a lot of the things that parade under the guise and the context of religion, you know, are the very opposite of what God teaches. Now maybe we say, well, yeah, you know, we don't do those things. We don't have idols. We don't have these various pictures and artifacts and symbols. We don't go around, you know, these little astrology, astrology signs, the various signs of the zodiac. We don't go around with those things. We don't have idols around. We don't bow down and worship these things. We know there are a number of other applications as to what it means to commit idolatry. You know, an idol was something that was used in worship. What does it mean to worship? Webster defines worship as adoration, unbounded admiration, extreme devotion, intense love. You know, it's interesting even some of the terminology we use. Don't we use the term idol today? People talk about matinee idols. They talk about movie stars. They talk about someone being my idol. And certainly various movie stars in a more recent date, various rock stars, the term idol, you know, calling someone a teenage idol. Well, what does it mean to worship? It means to adore, to have unbounded admiration for, extreme devotion to. Would you say that, you know, some of these people are properly called idols? Well, according to Webster's dictionary definition, there are a lot of people that worship some of these characters. You know, you go in some people's room and you think you were in a shrine. They've got all kinds of pictures and it looks like some kind of demon shrine because some of these things look horrible. You know, covering the wall. You expect to see incense there, you know, going up. I don't know, you know, if you do more, I don't know all of the rites that are attached to that. You know, you've got enough stuff there to make a real, real pagan scene there. But this type, when you see it, you know, some of these characters come to town. Whether it's the movie stars, the various rock stars or whatever, you see the way that certain people in unbounded devotion, they'll go down there and they'll stand in line for hours and hours. They'll scream and they'll shout and they just virtually lose themselves. They'll tear at the clothes. They will do anything and everything. Is that adoration, you know, kind of sit and gaze at the image, you know, like a beatific vision or something. Unbounded admiration, extreme devotion, intense love. Well, you know, there are various types of idolatry, and that can apply to a variety of things. You know, some people have an unbounded devotion. You know, you have an unbounded devotion to something, you are worshiping it. You know, your devotion to anything and everything except God needs to have certain bounds. Jesus Christ said, no one coming to Him that did not love much less by comparison, his father, his mother, his brother, his sister, you know, even his own wife, couldn't be his disciple. You know, what you put first in your life, what you give your allegiance to, what you give your devotion to, what you venerate, what you adore. Let's notice another application back in the book of Colossians. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5. We're told, mortify, put to death therefore your members which are upon the earth. Fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence or evil desire, lust, and covetousness which is idolatry. Here the Apostle Paul equates covetousness with idolatry. Now, why would covetousness be idolatry? Well, you know, when you covet something, when you are covetous of something, there is an adoration, there is an extreme devotion, there is a great desire, there is an allegiance that is there, you know, great desire for. Notice what God says He's going to do about some of that. There's going to be some hard lessons we're going to have to learn as a nation. We certainly need to go through and examine our own values and examine our own attitude. In Isaiah chapter 2, verse 5. O house of Jacob, come you and let us walk in the light of the eternal. Therefore you have forsaken your people, the house of Jacob, because they be replenished from the east or full of divinations from the east. And are soothsayers or astrologers, like the Philistines. They please themselves and the children of strangers. Their land also is full of silver and gold, full of material wealth. Neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land also is full of horses. Neither is there any end of chariots. We certainly recognize that here, Houston. Look at the freeway. Their land also is full of idols. Well, God says our land, the land of modern-day Israel, is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made. Now, what do we primarily worship in this land? We worship materialism. We worship, God says, the works of our own hands. The mean man bows down, the great man humbles himself, therefore forgive them not. Enter into the rock and hide you in the dust for fear of the Eternal, for the glory of His majesty. Speaking here of the time coming of the day of the Lord. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled. The haughtiness of men shall be bowed down. The Eternal alone shall be exalted in that day. For the day of the Eternal of hosts shall be upon every one that is proud and lofty, upon every one that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low. Upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, upon all the oaks of Bashan, upon all the high mountains and upon all the hills that are lifted up, upon every high tower, upon every fence wall, upon all the ships of Tarshish, upon all the pleasant pictures, referring here to these various idolatrous pictures. And the loftiness of man shall be bowed down, the haughtiness of men shall be made low, and the Eternal alone shall be exalted in that day. And the idols he shall utterly abolish. He's not going to leave some around for people to look at. You know, a lot of the great works of art are going to be destroyed. They're not going to survive. The idols he shall utterly abolish. And they shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth for fear of the Eternal and for the glory of His majesty when He arises to shake terribly the earth. People are going to go hide in the caves. They're going to be scared to death. This is made plain back in Revelation 9:6. In that day a man shall cast his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which they've made each one for himself to worship, to the moles and to the bats. Go into the clefts of the rocks, into the tops of the ragged rocks, for fear of the Eternal, for the glory of His majesty, when He arises to shake terribly the earth. Cease you from man whose breath is in his nostrils, or wherein is he to be accounted of? God says that He's going to shake the earth, and when the day of the Lord comes and Jesus Christ begins the process of judging the earth that final year prior to His return, the things that people have put their trust in this land, certainly the gods of materialism, our idols of gold and silver, and we have idols of gold and silver. You know, a lot of people think the way to prepare for the coming crash is to stock up on gold. Boy, they're going to be prepared. They're going to be in good shape. Well, you know, if you have a little bit of gold jewelry or something like that, and you can treat it as something that's nice or that's attractive or that's pretty, you know, that's one thing. But if you're thinking that you're somehow going to protect yourself, you know, you're going to put your trust, boy, you know, this paper money's going to collapse. I'm going to be prepared. I'm going to stock up on gold. Well, there are people that do that. God says that before all is said and done, they're going to throw their gold to the bats and the moles in the cave. He talks about, back in Revelation 6, it talks about that type of thing. How the stars of the heaven begin to fall and the heavens depart as a scroll. Kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the chief captains, the mighty men, every bondman, every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains. Send into the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of Him that sits on the throne, from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of His wrath has come. Who shall be able to stand? God is going to begin to intervene and shake the earth. People are going to find the things that they have put their trust in, the things they have put their confidence in, the things that they have looked to, have failed them. And that, of course, is something that we're going to have to encounter. We're going to have to realize. Brethren, as we look around, as we understand God's commandments, you know, God says we're not to use these various symbols in our worship. God seeks us to worship Him in spirit and in truth. We're not to make statuary or pictures or things like that to have a religious connotation, to be used as an instrument or an article of worship. We're not to bow down in front of something like that. In fact, we're not to have that kind of thing. All these various pagan symbols, and whether it be the little idols or whatever the connotation, you know, all these various idols and pagan symbols, God says those things are to be gotten rid of. Because the reason that God comes down on that, and the reason that God is so strong on that, is because when people get these ideas, these false concepts, these false attitudes in their mind, it cuts them off from the knowledge of the true God. It keeps them from understanding the greatness and the power and the grandeur and the might of the great Creator God. They began to visualize. They began to serve. They began to look to the creation rather than the Creator. You know, we're physical creatures. And we want to get our attention focused on physical things. That is our tendency as human beings. That's why God warns so emphatically against it. Because when we began to get our attention and we began to get our mind filled up with these various physical things, they actually limit God, at least in our mind. They give us a very limited concept of God. Not the true concept. Not the concept of power and glory and greatness and grandeur that the Bible pictures. We need to have our minds purged of these false ideas and these false attitudes and these concepts that we carry. Because we've grown up in an idolatrous world. And we need to examine ourselves for the various modern idolatries. Anything that we give our unbounded allegiance to, our adoration to, and it can be anything from material goods to the praise of other people. It can be anything from, a rock star to your own family. Anything that you allow to get in your way, anything that you allow to be put first in your life that you give an unbounded devotion to, that actually comes between you and God. We need, brethren, to really examine ourselves and understand that God's law defines for us God's character. It defines the way that God is, the way that God thinks. It tells us what is sin. It is that mirror, that perfect spiritual mirror into which we might look and see ourselves and see the areas of our lives that we need to shore up in and have more of the understanding of God's way and God's viewpoint, God's perspective. And began to sweep our mind clean of the cobwebs and the ideas and the attitudes that come from this world and from its ideas and its wrong attitudes.